afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Soundbites for this Saturday, July 22nd, 1995. I'm Bob Smith, and along with me around the table today, our panel of experts, Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray, are standing by to answer your questions, whether it be in the PC or the Macintosh realm. We've got the expertise at your fingertips if you dial in at 716-263-WXXI, or contact us on the internet. The address is talk1370@vivanet.com. Either way you go, we're looking forward to your questions and providing you answers on this, your users group of the air, Soundbites. The Justice Department says it has not yet decided whether or not to pursue a new antitrust action against Microsoft based on its plans to bundle the Microsoft network access with Windows 95. But the department has outlined a plan of action just in case. By including the software with Win 95, Microsoft is taking advantage of its market position in operating systems to gain advantage elsewhere, according to antitrust chief Ann Bingaman. And she says such use of economic power to gain advantage has been a persistent source of concern. Justice Department's trying to determine whether inclusion of the Microsoft network software, quote, raises rivals' costs, unquote, and thus impairs competition. Also, how fast Microsoft's online market share will grow, and whether information gathered through the MSN registration process could add to Microsoft's monopoly position. The CEOs of CompuServe, Prodigy, and America Online are asking Congress to support the Justice Department probing Microsoft's plan to bundle Microsoft network access. Not just an online service issue, we think it's a broader competitive issue, says AOL Chief Executive Steve Case. The executives argued that Microsoft's dominance in the operating systems market gives it an unfair advantage in the applications market. Apple Computer is saying a study by Competitive Assessment Services shows the Power Macintosh 9500 running a PowerPC 904 chip at 120 MHz has outperformed a 120 MHz Pentium by 51%. The Power Mac was even speedier when running graphics, publishing, scientific, and engineering programs. Results echoed in similar tests published recently in PC Week magazine. The Federal Trade Commission has taken the first step toward launching an investigation into computer makers' policies on selling machines made with previously used parts. The commission has requested documents from Packard Bell, Compaq, and Dell. Packard Bell's proposed class action settlement, stemming from its alleged practice of using used or returned parts in its new computers, could possibly change the rules for the entire PC industry. Under the terms of the settlement, Packard Bell does not have to label a computer refurbished or reconditioned if it contains returned parts that have not been used or opened. Also, the company may sell a returned computer that's been used for up to 100 hours, as long as that use took place within a single 30-day period after initial purchase. Software makers are worried that Japan's new policy of requiring that software products coming into the country be certified by the Japan Accreditation Bureau will give the JAB unprecedented access to U.S. software secrets, and they think the Japanese may possibly use that in order to steal some of the wrinkles of American competitive technology and bring Japanese software makers closer to being up to date with the world-leading American software manufacturers. A Motorola VP says, and we quote, people are concerned about Japanese auditors going through their software design process. U.S. software accounted for 32% of the software sold in Japan during the past year. Anxious to avoid a format war that would confuse customers, Sony and Toshiba have been trying to find a way to reach agreement on the format for digital video discs that will reach the market next year. Sony still wants one-sided discs, and Toshiba still wants two-sided discs. So Sony's new president has proposed development of playback machines that could possibly play either format. Apple CEO Michael Spindler is readying for battle as Microsoft's Windows 95 deadline grows closer. To compete, Apple plans to price aggressively in the pre-Christmas buying season. There is a perception we're priced at a substantial premium to our competition, says Spindler. It's not our intention as we move into the holiday period that perception continues. Moving risk down to the mainstream price points is going to be one part of the strategy. The argument that Mac costs too much will be less and less of an issue, as Spindler says he sees it. After announcing it had a backlog on mainframe orders that would extend into the first quarter of next year, IBM says this week that an internal memo to mainstream salespeople contends its supply of older bipolar mainframes will be ample to meet customer orders this year. Industry watchers say the about face is important gives Big Blue to Rattap its profit from mainframe sales and related services. The Computer Incident Advisory Capability, a U.S. Energy Department computer security group, has branded as false recent rumors circulating on the Internet that a new version of America Online software has a virus embedded in it. And that's this week's Computer News. You're listening to Sound Bites. And we are gathered here together today on this edition of Sound Bites to answer your questions. Well, how do you ask them? Well, it's very simple. Just pick up your telephone and dial 716-263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. Or, if you choose, contact us on the Internet, where the address is talk1370@vivanet.com. Incidentally, if you're wondering how to spell that, that's VIVANET.com. Talk1370@vivanet.com. And if you happen to have a direct Internet connection, or you call in through one of the major online services, you get through almost immediately, and we'll see your question and answer it for you right on the air. Whichever way you go, Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray are standing by with yours truly, Bob Smith, inviting you to get in and get tuned in. We're going to get into the phones in just a minute. But, gentlemen, first of all, I want
to... A moment of silence
that's
for
right.
Steve Ray.
I know. Dun, da-dun.
Bill Ball and Chain is rapidly closing.
Oh, good. He's listening in. It's already closing around your neck.
Surely that was your future husband who said that.
No, she went shopping.
There's nothing in the car or in the store?
And he's turning six shades of red.
If she's a medium, you're doomed.
You find out later. Well, it's true. I'm going to be the last single man around this table very soon.
Yeah.
Steve is taking the plunge.
The bad news is that Steve is no longer eligible, but the good news is that Bob still is.
That's right. Or maybe that's bad news, too. So my former girlfriends would tell you that. But anyway, enough of that. Enough about me, gentlemen. Let's go to the questions of the hour. Starting with this business of used parts and new machines. How seriously should we take that when we're going out shopping? Really?
How are you going to know?
Yeah. I guess that's a question.
I guess in most cases, less folks are really comfortable with, by the way, popping that cover and pulling all the components out and be able to physically identify which parts are used and which parts are new.
It's very hard to do.
Unless they're caked with dust. That's usually the giveaway.
Yeah, there's paint scraped off, say, where you put in the CPU chip, and it used to say Intel overdrive socket.
Yeah, right. I think it's pretty serious. I mean, if you're going to buy a new computer, you want a new computer. You know, the same would be true of cars. You don't want used parts in a theoretically new car. Although, if it's an electronic board, you know, and it hasn't been subjected to lightning or somebody's cigarette smoke, it really, you know, it's no big deal one way or the other. It's going to last 10 years or it's going to last 20 minutes if it passes that first 20 minutes.
Well, I've gotten brand new computers, which were really new by another manufacturer, come to the shop and it's dead.
Yep. It's happening a lot more lately. I don't know if it's just because I'm finding it with everybody I talk to as well as at RIT. Sometimes you get in a brand new machine and it's just dead. And I don't know if it's because people are using cheaper components now or simply because so many people are selling so many computers that quality has gone down.
It's probably a lot of both. The margins have gotten so tight. Now, I hear a lot of vendors from all sides of the equation looking back at the olden days of the 80s, when Apple had a 45% gross margin.
Yep.
And everybody was wishing they could get that back again.
Well, I have another major client who just brought in a brand new system, and they're sitting there and says, Steve, you got to come over and listen to this thing. And I started doing a check it test on it. He says, so is this supposed to sound like that? What it is the hard drive is thrashing like all hell.
Right.
Trying to write the data. I says, no, you got a bad hard drive. But it's a brand new machine. It's only 2 weeks old. So you've got a brand new case, new part, bad hard drive.
A lot depends also on how each company does their quality testing. You know, if they're churning out 10,000 computers a week, how many are they going to actually physically test? One out of 1,000 they pull off the assembly line? Yeah. Or
right, everybody does it by statistics. And it's interesting. I mean, the days when I used to sell computers, we sold Osborne's, and we were like the Western New York dealer. So if somebody came into the shop and said, I want an Osborne 1 computer... And they were very hot boxes for the day, very hot boxes, at a really good price. We would literally tell them, okay, but it's going to cost you list price. And people would smile and say, okay. And we say, in order to get in line, you have to give us the check now. And people would say, okay. And then we tell them, and oh, by the way, there's a 3-month waiting list. And they say, oh, is that all? Great. Nobody would put up with that now. But in those days, if you wanted that specific machine, because quantities were limited, they were taking, at least attempting, I guess, to take good care of quality, they only came off the assembly line at a certain rate. And you waited if you wanted one, and people wanted them.
Well, I get, right now, folks will drop stuff off the shop. You know, they'll drop it off in the morning. They're calling me and saying, is my computer ready yet? I go, wait a minute, this isn't Photomat. I just don't, you know, magically right. develop your computer and there's the problems and it's fixed.
Oh, well.
Crazy. Like you said, the attitude, whole mindset has
changed. Well, one thing we can promise is an instant answer to your question, what do you call it? And let's go to the phones now at 716-263-WXXI. Remind you, it is Soundbites on WXXI and WEOS-FM. Bob Smith with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, Steve Ray, and you. Good afternoon. You're on the air on Soundbites.
Yeah, this is Phil from Geneseo.
Hiya, Phil.
How you doing?
We're doing great. Good to have you with us.
Good. I just bought a used IBM computer 286.
And you knew it was used.
And I knew it was
used. Okay.
All right. With a 286, I think we can be pretty certain.
Well, you never know.
Okay. Now, on the hard drive, the only thing in the directory was a command com.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start up the computer, it would boot it up.
Sure.
And I loaded DOS onto the system,
mm-hmm.
and I was reading the DOS manual, and it says to delete the command com out of the DOS directory.
Right.
Well, by mistake, I deleted command com off the root directory.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can't boot up the system. And I tried putting it back in the command com.
Yeah.
On the root directory.
Yeah.
And it still won't boot up the system.
What error message do you get?
I don't get any messages. Well, it says non-systems disk is what it says.
Yeah. You probably can't just copy the command com back. You'd have to resys it.
Well, no, theoretically, if it worked before, if it booted up by itself.
Right.
And it came up and said, and ran, and then you just loaded DOS in, and then erased the command.com from the root.
Right.
It should still boot up and say, cannot find command, insert diskette with command.com and drive A, what it should say.
Yeah.
If, in fact, it says, that's interesting, if in fact it says non-system disk or disk error,
mm-hmm. are you using the same version of DOS? In other words, the version of DOS that came with the computer, you know, that command.com, is that, if you can remember, the date that was formatted with versus the version of DOS you're trying to put on?
No, it's different.
Okay, then what you really want to do is this. Take your DOS disk and boot the system with it.
Okay.
Then type the following. Sys. S-Y-S, space, A colon.
C colon.
Oh, excuse me.
I tried that with a C colon, and it said incorrect DOS version.
Yeah, but you got to boot up with your current version of DOS. You got to turn the machine off. You just can't have the machine in there, and you've got to actually boot it up
with the floppy.
With the floppy in there.
Yeah, the copy I have is there's three different disks for the DOS version.
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, use whichever... Boot up with whichever one has the sys program on it.
Okay.
And then sys the drive, and then reboot the system from the C drive and type DER. That will tell you what version of DOS you have loaded.
Right.
And then load all the utilities into the DOS directory that match that version of DOS.
Okay.
You might have to use the number one disk to boot with, and then the second disk might have sys on it, and you'll just have to swap disks. Once you boot it, just do a dir and you'll find the sys.dir command.
Okay, yeah, I've tried booting it up using the DOS disk, but it doesn't recognize it as a system disk.
Then it's not a system disk. Well, that's interesting. Now, your hard drive doesn't recognize the system, and your floppies don't recognize the system?
Right.
What you need to do is borrow from a friend
mm-hmm.
a known bootable diskette.
Okay, I have one, but it's a different version than the DOS that I have in the system.
What version of DOS you got on the system? Let's get
5.5.0.
You might just be better off biting a bullet and going out and getting a DOS, a version of DOS.
Okay, then.
And starting right from scratch and then just boot up that first disk and it'll lead you right through installing it. And then you're legal and everything else, as well as the fact that you know the right version of DOS is in there.
Okay. All right. Thanks, gentlemen.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Hey, good luck. Let us know what happened.
Okay, thanks.
Here we go. Next to another caller at 716-263-WXXI. And hi, you're on the air on Soundbites.
Hi, this is Art.
Art, how are you?
good. I remember those days of waiting for an Osborne.
You were one of them.
You're right. And
you were delighted when you got it, weren't you?
You bet your
life.
It
was worth the wait.
Yeah, but then you had to wait another 6 months for the magnifying screen.
Yeah, right. That's right.
I could see better then.
Well, you know, you talk about the upgrades that everybody has to go through now. In the Osborne days, we had an upgrade to go to an 80-column screen, an upgrade to go to double-sided drives. It was pretty amazing back then, too.
One of the first Apple IIs had an upgrade to use lowercase.
Right.
The first Apple II only had uppercase. 40 columns, uppercase.
We had quite a brisk little business running that little wire down into the system to make the shift key work for the software lowercase. Remember that? Sorry, Art, what's your question?
That's all right. I'm looking now at something that is something I heard you could never do, and that's a flyer for a program called Partition Magic, which now says you can partition your disk without erasing data, and you do it on
the fly.
It's amazing.
Yes, I've seen it done, and it's pretty neat. Because if you need another, say, 20 meg from your D drive over to your C drive, you just run this program, and it redoes the partition tables, updates the FAT file, and says, "Okay, now you got 20 more meg over here."
So it really works.
Oh yeah,
it really works.
Yep.
It all started with Spin Disk, which was a program that let you reformat your hard drive.
Spin write,
thank you. On the fly.
Okay.
And I thought that was magic. And now you can even change the partition table. That's real magic. It's a great program.
Is it true hard partitions or soft partitions?
No, it's, well, I don't know. There's not a difference. You don't physically partition your hard drive. It's all done in software.
There have been partitioning software out for the Mac that will create a 20 meg file on your main disk and look
No, no, no. This is actual physical drive partitions. If you went into FDisk, you'd see the real partition there correctly.
Cool.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
It is. It's magic.
Just wanted to check.
Thanks, Art.
Righto.
Hey, thank you very much for calling. We check in at 263-WXXI with yet another call. And hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I was hoping some of your listeners could help me out here. I'm putting together a focus group on virtual reality, just trying to get some people's impressions of it, what have they tried it, and where they think it should go, etc. And we're going to be having this Thursday night, July 27th at 7 p.m. for about 2 hours.
Where at?
Well, what I'd like is people to call me if they're interested.
Okay, and your name?
My name is Claire, and my phone number is 454-1010.
Okay.
So if people could give me a call, we're looking for about 8 to 10 people, and we'll be giving away some games and free pizza.
Cool.
So.
Now I might show up.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you, Claire.
Bye.
Thanks for checking in. 263-WXXI, incidentally, how you check in. Steve, it's up to you on the case.
Yeah, Apple has recently released their new QuickTime VR technology on their webpages, www.quicktime.apple.com. And it's absolutely amazing what they can do, and what's most amazing is the file sizes. I've got a 400K picture file that's just a picture of a scene, and you load it into the VR player, and then you have full three-dimensional control spinning around inside this picture, viewing it at any angle, looking up, looking down. You can zoom in, zoom out, and it's all done with the QuickTime technology and not needing a separate image rendered for every single perspective and every view like most games and VR systems need today.
That sounds like an awful small file size to do that much and have that much capability in it.
It's amazing. Although I do have an 8 meg VR file that's a Star Trek tricorder with all the little lights blinking on it. And what's really amazing is you can rotate it in three-dimensional space and all the lights keep blinking.
Nice!
That's probably why it's 8 megs.
Yeah, right.
that's impressive. 716-263-WXXI is the number that you call, or if you've got a question that you'd like to send us flashing over the internet, the address is talk1370@vivinet.com. Either way, you get right into sound bites on WXXI Rochester, WEOS-FM Geneva. Bob Smith with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, Steve Ray, and you with your questions. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Glenn from East Rochester.
Hey, Glenn.
Got two questions for you. I am a PC person who finds himself lost in a Mac world. I just started a job with a Mac on the desk, and I'm clueless.
It's a frightening place to be.
It is, isn't it? They talk about it being intuitive. That's a matter of opinion as far as I'm concerned.
But it's a lot of it is just different from what you're used to.
That's what they keep telling me, and I'm hoping I'll get used to it. Here's question number one. I've got some stuff on the PC that I'd like to move to the Mac, specifically at least one graphic file, which I've saved in about 11 different configurations, GIF and TIFF and Mac and you name it. I don't seem to be able to port this thing over to the Mac. Anybody got any suggestions for how to handle that?
Does it fit on a single disk?
Oh, yeah.
Stick the DOS disk into the Mac drive and it shows up on the desktop.
Yeah, but then I can't do anything with it. The only way it shows up is as text.
Then you haven't configured your PC Exchange properly.
Okay.
You need to open the PC Exchange control panel.
Okay.
Which lets you map the DOS file extensions like GIF.
Right, I've seen that.
Into a Macintosh application like either Photoshop or one of the other graphic image programs.
Are you familiar with Freehand?
Yes.
I've got Freehand. Would that work?
Freehand is a PostScript program. It will only open EPS PostScript files.
Okay, so I need some kind of a graphics program that will handle the GIF file.
Yes, there's a shareware program called Graphic Converter that converts pretty much every graphic format on any platform. There's even some Amiga and Sun Raster graphics formats that are very weird. And it also does some basic editing functions to them as well.
Now, is that something I could download? See, I have no... That's question number two, and we'll get to that in a minute. I need to figure out some way to work a modem on this thing so I could download stuff from AOL and the like. Is that something I could take over from the PC to the Mac on a disk and run?
Yes.
Okay.
But the catch-22 is that every Mac file you download is encoded with a Mac binary envelope.
Right.
Which is just the difference in file structure. So you need to have a Mac binary decoder on the Mac, which must be downloaded with a Mac in the first place.
How did I know you were going to say that? Okay.
Macintoshes are easy.
Well, the easiest thing to do is to just put a modem on the Mac.
Okay.
And go to any newsstand and get any one of the thousands of AOL disks you'll find there.
True. No lie.
You guys have any contacts on what to do with all those old AOL disks?
I have. Oh, listen, I'm building a rec room out of it. I have AOL on the computer at work. It came installed on the computer. The problem I'm having is getting a modem to work. I've got a modem, and by God, these things have got more like little plugs on them than anything we ever saw for the PC. The only problem is that I'm working at a
phone jack, and there should be a serial port.
Yeah, well, yeah, but see, here's the problem. I'm working on a phone system at work. I called ICS Executone, who put this thing in. I said, is this a digital PBX system? And they said, no, it's not. It's analog. Go ahead and use your modem. The only problem is when I plug the modem into I plug the cord into the wall, and a phone into the modem, and the computer into the modem, and the whole nine yards. I've got to wire it up just like it says to do, but I can't get a dial tone.
How many phone lines do you have on your phone?
Two, at least, that I can tap. I've got two outgoing lines on the phone.
That may be the problem. If you're not using the RJ11 and RJ14 formats with the four-wire conductors, it could be somewhere you've got a telephone switch box that's able to multiplex phone lines on your single wire.
Okay, so
in my office, we've got six phone lines running on four wires, and it's some pretty fancy telephone computers that do that.
So in other words, in order to run a modem, I'd almost have to have a separate line into the office.
Either that, or you have to have some way to isolate a single pair of wires with one phone line on it.
You're going to break out one line.
Okay. This sounds like it's a bit more complicated than I can handle. All right.
Good luck.
You've told me my answer, and the answer is no.
Well, the answer is it takes a little longer to do it than to just plug it in.
Yeah, in other words, it's not as easy as a PC.
Well, in the modem case, you'd have the same problem in the PC.
Right, it has nothing to do with the computer. It's your office.
Okay.
The other thing you might want to try is call the Apple Users Group at 251-APPLE, because we can also help you with your questions offline as well.
Oh, that would be real helpful, because I seriously am lost on this thing. 251-APPLE, you said?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Hey, I appreciate the help, guys.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Take it easy. We go to another call. Hi, you're on the air on Soundbites.
Hi, I have two questions. The first one is, on a PC system, how do you really delete a file? I have some data that's sensitive and I don't want accessible to anybody who happens to walk up to my PC, and I figured I could just use zip with some password and encrypt the information. But Microsoft is also delivered some utilities called undelete. So if I zip the file and then delete the original, you just go in and undelete it, and it's right there.
Yeah, the only secure approved way, DoD approved way of deleting data on the disk is a 10,000-pound press.
Okay.
Right, yeah. barring that, there are a couple of choices. There are some shareware programs available on the BBSs that will actually fill a, when it erases a file, it'll fill that space with zeros or ones.
Okay.
In addition, if you get Norton Utilities,
okay,
they have a wipe, I think it's called.
Wipe info. And same with PC Tools.
Same with PC Tools.
Okay.
So either one of those would give you a program that'll actually, when you erase the file, it actually wipes the sectors clean that it was in.
Okay, do you know any of the names of the shareware programs or where I could find them?
Off the top of my head, I do not, but try the PCCube BBS at
723-8489 and just go into the various utility areas.
Okay.
Or you can scan the CD-ROMs, and I'm sure you'll find something there.
Yeah, do a search on wipe or delete.
Okay, that was 723-8489. Okay,
yep.
The second question is with my modem. Everything was going fine. I was dialing into the system, and then all of a sudden one day it stopped working. And I tried another, I was running it 14.4, 8-bit, no parity, one stop bit. And all of a sudden it stopped working. I take the PC to work, and it worked. And I think there's some noise on the phone line. And I don't know how to go about tracking down. The first thing I did is I unplugged all the phones in my house, all the answering machines, and so there was nothing but my house generating noise. The question is, how do I go about looking for noise on a line? I'm sure if I call a phone company, they're going
to... First thing you want to do is plug a real phone into the modem line.
Okay.
And listen.
I can do that because I have a speaker on.
No.
Okay.
Because that speaker is not particularly good.
Okay.
Plug into there and call somebody.
Okay.
And then listen and see if you hear crackling stuff in the background.
Okay, well, I don't hear crackling right now, but...
The second thing to do is, your modem works at work?
Yep, works at work.
The second thing to do is to actually call the phone company and ask if they're working on a switch in your neighborhood.
Okay.
In fact, there may be nothing you can do.
Uh-huh.
They may also have you on a SLIC, which stands for Subscriber Line Interface Complex, Combination,
okay.
Something. And what that is, you remember the old party line?
Yeah.
Where four or five people would share a line?
Right.
It's back.
Okay.
It's called a SLIC. And they do it electronically. They multiplex and timeshare among half a dozen people down one line. Now, if you are doing this voice, you can't tell.
Right.
The human brain, being an incredible computer, hears that little break in the tone and deals with it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it doesn't have a problem with it.
I thought that if you're using a modem, though, it just tagged the line and they couldn't do them up.
Nope. So you could still be multiplexing and find out if you're on a SLIC and then have them take you off it.
Oh, and I just tell them to take me off?
Well, I don't know that that'll work, but certainly that's the only choice you have.
Okay. It works at 9600, but I can't get through the 14.4 line?
If it works at 9600, that's a good indication that you're on a SLIC.
Okay.
You just can't handle the faster throughput.
Right.
Okay.
What the phone company will probably offer to do is put you on a dedicated data line at like $50 a month.
Yeah, a little extra.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to pay that, but okay. And how fast does your bulletin board go at?
The PCCube BBS.
28.8.
Okay.
The Frog Pond BBS has two lines. The members line is at 28.8, and the open line is currently at 2400, but I've got a 9600 baud modem coming from one of our members. So.
Okay.
Marty Bechtel is going to bring me in.
Did you see U.S. Robotics just released a, 33.6 modem?
Yeah.
So they've gone beyond 28.8 already.
Yeah. I have not heard any reports on it, however, as to whether or not it's...
Even now at 28.8, we're pushing the capabilities of the phone lines and what we've...
Well, that's why I wonder how much you're really going to hear 33s catch on, because 28.8, according to Dennis Hayes, was the top end that you could push a phone line.
And even then, do you watch your actual connect speeds? Because I know people with 28.8s that rarely get a 26. They usually get a 24, and most often 22.
What's interesting is that when I connect to RIT, I get consistently 26 and often 28. And when I connect to Vivinet, I usually get a 28 and sometimes 26. I'm very surprised.
And you're in an old part of the town.
I'm in an old part of town.
In an old house.
Yeah, right. In the shadow of all those towers.
In the shadow of Pinnacle Hill.
Hey, well, good luck anyway.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, 263-WXXI or talk 1370 at vivinet.com. And I am remiss. I have not yet gone to the internet. We're going to do it right now. And this one starts with a comment from Wayne in the city. He says,
Windows 95 warning, computer risks needs to be heard. He says that Microsoft officials are confirming that the beta of Windows 95 includes a small, he calls it a viral routine called Registration Wizard. We've talked a little bit about this before, but this is a better explanation than I've seen before. Apparently what it does is it interrogates every system on a network, gathering intelligence on what software is being run on which machine. It then creates a complete listing of Microsoft's and competitors' products by machine, which it reports to Microsoft when customers sign up for Microsoft Network Service due for launch later this year.
Yep.
And Wayne's comment, the implications of this action and the attitude of Microsoft to plan such action beggars the imagination.
Well, yeah, it's pretty interesting. Remember when Prodigy...
There was Prodigy almost got shut down for this.
Is exactly right. But, in fact, Prodigy wasn't doing it.
Yeah.
What happened was with Prodigy, they had a big area on your hard drive that was... they called it swap or something like that. And they have all these graphics that they download to your machine, and they put them in that area. But when they saved the area, when they created the area, they didn't wipe it out. They didn't zero out the space. So if you actually looked in it to see what was there, you would find, you know, a letter to your aunt that had been left in that space and erased or moved.
Like our last caller was
talking
about.
And so people were saying, oh, they're uploading the stuff from my hard drive. Well, in fact, they were not, but it did almost shut them down. People were really angry. And now Microsoft is actually doing it, literally really doing it, gathering information about what's in your machine and reporting it back to them. I personally am not a fan of Big Brothers. I don't have a problem with somebody running Windows 95, but I certainly would have a problem with the MSN, the Microsoft Network. I'm never going to sign on, I'll tell you that right now. Well, I just don't trust them.
Microsoft's official response is that they want to know what you have on your machine, so when you call for help, they can better understand your problems.
Well, then let me fill out a survey and put it in paper. Well, not scan my whole darn network.
It does sort of make a little sense, because when you call tech support, the first thing they say is, what model computer do you have? What speed's it at? What software are you running? What version of DOS? What TSRs?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. And then I'll say, okay, what button do I push to send you that information?
Mm-hmm.
What button do I push to send you that information?
Yep.
That's my choice. Don't take that choice away from me. A friend of mine was arguing with me this week because he said that I would never tell anybody to run Windows. I would never recommend anybody run Windows 95 in the first release. But I've got it on my machine at work.
Before the first release.
Yeah, right. The point is, I would never recommend to anybody to run it, because if they've got a question, then they'll probably call me. And you're going to have questions, you're going to have problems, release 1.0, forget about it. But if you want to run it, you know, certainly feel free
to.
Don't expect it to run well, and expect to find that Microsoft is doing things like this, because they're getting cocky. They're getting real cocky.
Oh, big cocky. I heard some other rumors as far as their licensing, you know, like if I've got a network and say, I've got five folks on there, I've got a 20 user network, and I've only got five, office managers that are using a network version of, say, Word. Well, Microsoft is now going to sit there and say, well, sorry, you got 20 users. That's the size license you got to buy, no longer the small one, and be possibly shared by other folks.
Yeah, and it used to be that you could do that across time zones as well, and now you cannot.
There's been a lot of articles in the paper recently on especially businesses. Skepticism and hesitation about whether they're going to even load Windows 95 at all because of the massive support it's going to need for all the existing software. Who knows what's going to work and what's not going to work.
Plus the upgrade
and the hardware and software requirements of the level of machine you're going to have to buy.
Microsoft has a list of hundreds of programs that do not run, and they do not expect them to run. Well, you know that's half of what's on. Half of those programs are on your machine. You know that already.
It's probably their own software is going to work. Which is something the FTC should look into.
Although I am told that's not even completely true. I don't know which.
No,
one.
not every one of the programs.
Not every Microsoft
works.
Program
All of their NT programs run.
Yeah.
So if you want to upgrade to NT, oh, I'm sorry, there's no upgrade to the NT product. You have to buy them new.
Son of a gun.
Oh well. 263-WXXI, area code 716, and hi, you're on the air on Sound Bites.
Good afternoon. This is Mark from Rochester.
Hey, Mark.
First,
at least
comment.
It's not Paula. You'll be calling.
Well, that's next.
First, a comment. I keep thinking you guys ought to go national, but I think, oh no, because then we'd never be able to get through on the phones.
Well, thank you, Mark. We'd love to go national. You got a couple hundred thousand in your pocket?
No, I don't.
Oh well.
Okay, my question is: recently, I got a 14.4K fax modem. Everything was installed wonderfully. However, now when I boot up my machine, I get this message, invalid configuration information, please run setup program. And when I run the, when I do that, everything seems to me to be set all right, and yet every time I boot up, I still get the same message. So I press the F1 key and just go on with it, but that gets a little annoying. Any suggestions?
What type of computer was it?
It's Packard Bell 46SX.
Okay. On those machines, quite often you've got to make sure that the memory, is seeing the memory correctly.
Yeah, you're going to have to check as it boots up to see how much memory it thinks it has.
Mm-hmm.
What, go into the setup and see what size hard drives it thinks it has.
Okay.
What floppies it thinks are installed.
Yeah, I
what
saw that.
Serial and, how many serial and parallel ports you've got.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things.
One thing you can try to do is down usually the bottom of the screen, I think it's F6, you can take the BIOS default settings.
Okay. Yeah, I did that too.
Okay. And then that'll usually go out and
check.
Yeah,
it still does it?
Yeah. Because I put the new modem on COM2, so if I use the default settings, then it doesn't realize my modem there anymore.
It only thinks
the one that was installed on COM1 is there.
But the thing of it is, though, is if you've got COM2 on the machine, did you disable that, the external COM2, before you hooked up? This is an internal modem?
It's an internal modem, yeah.
Yeah. If you put it on COM2 and you've got a COM2 in there...
Okay, I don't. I mean, it's got...
It you disabled it?
Well, maybe that's what I need to do. Internal COM2?
Yeah, each computer comes with two COM ports, COM1, COM2. COM1 is usually the mouse, and they can use COM2 for, you know, like the old plotters or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, what folks are doing is disabling the COM port on the I.O. card or the motherboard for COM2 and slipping in a modem,
mm-hmm.
you know, an internal modem, and put that on COM2.
Okay.
Hey,
thank you very much.
Hey, we go to another call right now. Hi, you're on the air on Soundbites.
Hi, this is Karen from Brackport. I have a quick question on PC hardware.
Okay.
When I'm initially turning on my computer for the first time in the day, about half the time lately, the screen blanks out after a minute or two. Usually it's while Windows is starting up or when I'm trying to start the first software program I want to use. It's okay after I push the reset button. Reboot it. And it's just a nuisance now. I really haven't lost any work because it's been right at the beginning of a session. But is it time to get a new video board?
I don't know as if it's as much a video card as maybe a hard drive or a controller card spinning up on you. Do you hear the hard drive spin up?
Yeah.
And it's that's spinning up okay?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have the monitor plugged into the computer or straight into the wall?
I think it's plugged into the computer.
Maybe a marginal power supply.
Yeah. Could be.
What it sounds like is happening is that something needs to warm up before you start something else. And the problem is I can't tell you what those somethings are. And so that the first time you start it up, something is failing.
Uh-huh.
And then the second time you start it up, it's had some juice for a while, it's gotten warmed up, and it's ready to go. The problem is finding that component.
I would like Steve was saying there, if it is plugged into the back of the computer... Try plugging the monitor right on into the wall.
You may need a different cable.
Yeah, an adapter.
Which you can buy. You can buy those adapter cables at any one of the local dealers. And plug that directly into the wall. And try turning that on for a minute or two, 30 seconds, before you turn your computer on.
Okay.
And see if that solves the problem.
Now, what size monitor is it?
Oh, it's a standard size.
14?
Not one of those giant ones.
A lot of times, the larger monitors draw too much power to get plugged into the battery.
Could be enough coming off that power supply if you got a weakened power supply.
Try that first.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, thanks for checking in. We take another call right now. Hi, you're on the air on Soundbites.
Hi, this is Jerry walking down Park Ave.
Hey, Jerry, how are you doing?
Nick, how are you doing?
Good.
What's the name of that program that does the partition on the fly?
Partition Magic.
Partition Magic, okay. Last point, the guy who has the 286,
mm-hmm.
he can't buy DOS out there without having on machines first. Somebody's going to have to give him a copy of the...
Well, he can buy the update.
Yeah, but if it doesn't have DOS on the machine, it won't work.
Well, but it should work now because he's got... he had DOS working, and now it's just stopped for some reason.
He killed a command comp. I did that, and I had to buy the program and give you a copy of it from MS-DOS.
Yeah.
For 6.22 that allows you to set the threat.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Even though he had it on his machine already.
I killed... I command comp on a machine, and I couldn't get it back down there. I had to buy the program from MS-DOS.
Wow.
Yeah, because if you buy the full version, you got a first F disk to drive.
Yeah.
Delete the old partition, create the new one, which would be no big loss to them anyways, and then just reboot up and then format the drive.
$35.
Yeah.
For the whole program.
They're still cheap than buying actually the whole version of DOS.
Well, you know, I'd give it to somebody if they bought the upgrade so to get them started.
Yeah.
In other words, if somebody needed one, they could borrow it.
Mm-hmm.
They could then, I get the machine going, because when you switch the machine from Xenix or some other, and then if they have the upgrade, they paid for that, then it doesn't make any difference. They paid the copyright cost.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other thing to watch out for is with an older 286, he probably still has 5 1/4 drives. So you may have to buy DOS off the shelf for 3.5 and send the coupon back for 5 1/4.
Right. Yep.
Very good, guys. Thanks a lot.
Hey, good luck. Sorry,
partition what? Magic?
Partition magic.
Very good. Thank you.
Good luck. Right. Let's take another call as soon as we remind you you've got Soundbites on WXXI Rochester, WEOS FM Geneva. I'm Bob Smith with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, Steve Ray, and you at 716-263-WXXI or Talk 1370 at vivinet.com. And hi, you're on the air. Welcome to Soundbites.
Hello, this is Nick. I'm a first-time caller. I've listened a few times before. I really find it interesting.
Glad to have you with us. Welcome to the family.
Appreciate it. Well, good name, too, by the way.
Yeah, I sort of fond of it myself.
We're pretty rare.
But anyway, I have a question. I have both the Mac LC2 and I have a new Gateway 486. Since this LC2 Mac runs at 16 megahertz there, I've been taking a look at some of the accelerators in the catalogs recently that have come out. There's a 50 megahertz accelerator, supposedly, that will fit the LC2. Apparently, it has a slots for extra SIMs, so you can get past the 10 megabyte barrier, because that particular machine has no PMMU unit. So I'm wondering, is that going to fry anything? Is there really, I've seen upgrades to double it to 32 megahertz, but this is going to 50 megahertz. I'm not really sure. This is the only one I've seen that actually does that. Any feelings on whether this is really going to shorten the life of this computer, or should I buy an extra cooling fan or something like that?
An extra cooling fan would always be good. The LCs were the low cost models from a few years ago, and they have a fairly small power supply.
Mm-hmm.
So putting an accelerator in, you want to make sure that you're not going to overtax the power supply. The other major problem with the LC is it only has a 16-bit bus. It's much like a 386SX. It doesn't have the full 32-bit bus like the fuller machines. One of the best upgrades that exists for the LC is going to a Quadra 605 motherboard, which gives you a 25 megahertz 040 processor, which is probably going to be several times faster than any 030 processor accelerator you can get. And I've seen it's also called the LC475, which was the educational version of it. And I've seen that for $300-$400 at some of the resellers in the back of the magazines.
Uh-huh. That's really just the motherboard then.
Right, you're replacing the entire motherboard, specifically because the LC has a 16-bit bus. So any accelerator you put in is going to be limited by that 16-bit bus.
Uh-huh. Well, basically I have a graphics program that keeps on... I would like to be able to switch back and forth from various areas of this program. I'm wondering, say, even if I just go to a real low cost, that there's something like $150 now to go to a 32 megahertz accelerator, will that really speed up the graphics considerably? I know I have supposedly 32-bit addressing on the LC2, but...
Well, you have 32-bit addressing, but it does it 16 bits at a time.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, so I guess that answers my question there. One other question. As I start up the gateway, it goes through a bunch of stuff that it's too fast to read it there. How do I get how do I get to stand still so I can read through the whole darn thing?
When it starts up,
yep.
And it says starting MS-DOS,
mm-hmm.
That sits on the screen for about a second.
Yeah.
When you see that, hit F8. It will then let you step through every single thing that happens in config.sys and autoexec.dat. And it'll ask you yes or no, do you want to run this one? That's also a good thing, by the way, to know if you've changed something in your config.sys and all of a sudden your system locks up,
mm-hmm.
and won't finish the boot process. You can hit that F8 and say yes until you get done with that new command, say no, finish your boot process and then take it
that
out.
That is one of the best features,
yeah.
the F8 and F5 putting in DOS that they ever did for DOS.
And yeah, an F5 completely bypasses your config.sys and autoexec.bat, except for the path state. So that you get your and the prompt state. So you get your path and you're on your way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for checking in. Got an internet question that's interesting. Steve, this one's yours. Ed wants to know in the city, any idea when Apple will make Open Transport, the replacement for Mac TCP, available? He knows it's shipping on the new PowerMac 9500, but that's about it the last he knew. Any hope for the rest of the Mac world getting it?
I think it's on the FTP site now. I've seen it on several of the developer CDs. One of the big things with the new 9500 is it comes with a new version of the operating system with more PowerMac native resources. And everybody's hoping that they're going to release this new version for the first round of PowerMacs that will make them faster as well.
Mm-hmm.
What we're starting to see and hearing from problems inside Apple is that the new operating system relies on new ROM code built into the 9500. So it may require a ROM upgrade also, which Apple has never done.
So
it might be a first for them as well.
Right.
But, yeah, you should be able to poke around the FTP site and find Open Transport.
And a quick question from Kay in Rochester wanting to know, has any of us signed up for ISDN offered by Rochester Tel? Last time she called, they had a per-minute charge on top of the $30 a month basic charge. Is that still the case? She's heard conflicting reports on it.
That's what I've heard.
That's what I've heard.
And yeah, that's why I have not signed up myself. I'd love to do ISDN. But it's a little too expensive, and then that additional per-packet charge is ridiculous. And I understand why they want to do it. I mean, after all, that, you know, the phone companies have this mentality. If you're going to use our wire, we want as much money as we can from you.
Well, it's like anything else. It's so new until, you know...
But it isn't anymore. You know, it's going to be replaced by all this cable.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, though, is that right now they're still riding on the high end of the wave, you know, because they think it is so new. And if people want it that bad, just like when VCRs first came out.
Right.
Yeah.
See, I can't wait for the cable stuff to come in, because then ISDN, they're going to give it away.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, and that's when I'm going to get ISDN.
Yeah, absolutely. Free is enough better than free.
Yeah, I've got a couple of friends that are seriously researching the ISDN. One of the problems is that you don't have a digital phone, so you can't use your modem anymore.
You have to use a special modem.
Right, you have to use an interface. And it used to be these interfaces were several $1,000s. But now there's several companies that have under $500 boxes to connect your computer into the ISDN. Most of the companies call it an ISDN modem, which isn't technically
accurate,
correct.
But yeah.
Correct. The other thing to worry about is that most of the internet service providers charge more for ISDN access than they do for modem access. So
right.
Check into that as well.
Right.
One quick tip from Charlie before we go back to the phones in Rochester over the internet. He says if you delete a file and then do a full defrag of your hard drive, most of the deleted area will be overwritten when the files are moved to their new location. So effectively,
true, but that's not as sure as using one of these.
Foolproof. Okay. And with that, we go to another call. And hi, you're on the air on Soundbites.
Yes, Hank, Henrietta. I'm thinking about buying a new machine, and I'm would be using a standalone, doing spreadsheets and word processing and some graphics. And I was wondering... from getting into the Pentium area, what speed should I really think about buying?
Whatever, the fastest machine you can afford.
There's great deals out there right now. You just got to shop around.
Yeah, there's no set thing anymore, you know, where you can draw up a chart and say, I need this, I need this, I need this. The stuff you're doing, you really don't need, except for maybe the graphics stuff, you don't even need a 486. You can do it with a 386, but you can't buy one anymore. So whatever suits your wallet is going
to
work well for you.
There's a couple of questions you can ask yourself. You buy the most you can afford, which means it will last 6 months longer.
Right.
But then don't buy more than you need. So it's a delicate balance between
the
two.
Well, like right now you can get like a DX 100, you know, cheaper than the Pentium, but it'll run faster than, the Pentium 75 or Pentium 90.
Right.
So, you know, you still got all that power, you won't pay as much, and you still got one machine that's going to do you for a while for what you're doing. And we go to another call right now. We're going to try to get in as many as we can, go to break in just a few minutes. And hi, you're on the air on Soundbites.
Hi, this is Steve from Webster.
Hey, Steve.
I've got a question about my DOS shell ini file. I've had a couple of accidents recently, one at work and one at home, where the thing kind of got chowed down on due to the computer shutting down when it shouldn't have. And in one case I had a backup, and in one case I didn't, so I kind of lost color choices and stuff like that. In the process of typing these things. It looks to me like you can get in there and alter these things by hand.
Sure you can.
Mm-hmm. What I want to know is, where would I read about that? I don't see any documentation with the DOS manual or anything.
For DOS Shell, I haven't seen any documentation.
No.
You know, people are coming out with stuff for Win.ini. Pete Moore had a whole set of articles in the LilyPad for the Frog Computer Society. But as far as DOS Shell, I don't know that anybody's really torn it apart and put together some sort of list of what's available for that one, I'm afraid. Your best bet is to go through the program. And I know that there are some things that you can do in most INI files that you cannot do through the program, but I don't know where you would find that information, sir.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, thanks for checking in. I think we got time to squeeze in at least one more. And hi, you're on the air on Soundbites.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Norman Bright. Two questions.
Yes?
Yes.
Go ahead, Norman.
We're waiting.
Okay. Two comments. One on deleting the file. If you write over it with another file, say copy command com or something like that onto the other file, you will totally wipe out the original file.
But there's no way to tell it to copy onto the other file.
You're right. It may not necessarily hit all the same sectors.
You copy a bigger file onto a smaller file.
Yeah, that'll work about 98% of the time. That's right.
Okay, the other thing you can do, if you have a monitor, or if you plug a monitor into the back of the computer,
mm-hmm.
it's not drawing power from the power supply. You just have 110 coming in and going through and coming back out.
Some of them do. That allows you to power on your monitor from the computer as well.
Then it's
and
going to a relay, but it's not using the 5 volt or 12 volt that the monitor is using, or that the computer is using. So you're not loading down the power supply itself. You're picking a relay that you pick even if you didn't have a monitor plugged in.
Well, this is what we're trying to get to our norm, though, is we think that maybe even just that relay within the system might be having problems, because you were saying it had to, like, warm up a little bit. So there could be a default within the relay within that power supply. So that's why we were telling her, get the adapter, hook the monitor right into directly into the wall, you know, grab the power from there and see if that solves the problem, because there could be a faulty relay in the power supply.
Right. She'd probably hear it chattering, though.
Yeah, she didn't say, you know, one way or the other. So that's why we told her that's the cheapest way. Just go out and buy that adapter cord and plug it into the wall. It's the cheapest thing to do, first off.
Right. Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Okay. Hey, no, thank you very much for checking in. Boy, I wish we had more time to deal with more questions, but unfortunately, time is just about up right now for this particular segment of Sound Bites. But I do want to remind you to stay tuned with your pencils and papers ready. Because right now, you are going to hear about some very interesting programs that you can download right off PCQ Bulletin Board. Paul Casarino, PCQ, is coming by. He's going to offer shareware jams.
With so many millions now surfing the Internet, many users have become concerned about the privacy of the email that they send all around the world. Philip Zimmerman has solved that problem with a program called PGP, for Pretty Good Privacy. Though quite complex in its underlying operations, PGP basically allows the author of a message to digitally sign that message and encrypt it in such a way that only the intended recipient may view the message, and by doing so knows that the message has not been tampered with. WinPGP 3.1 is the latest version of a Windows-based front-end for PGP. Now, using your favorite Windows editor, you can implement the security functions of PGP. WinPGP has toolbar buttons, real Windows help for both WinPGP and PGP, a launch button for telecommunications products, an improved clipboard button, and now multi-file encryption. WinPGP even has full key management capability that many other Windows shells don't have. Now, 5% of net registration goes to Philip Zimmerman's legal defense fund. For those of you who use the Blue Wave offline mail reader, PGP Blue is an interface program which interfaces PGP with Blue Wave. You can encrypt and decrypt messages that have been encrypted using PGP, add a public key, post a public key, list the contents of your public key to the screen. All sorts of features that are normally implemented with PGP you can now do directly through Blue Wave. As anyone in the publishing business will tell you, electronic publishing is a hot topic. There have been several attempts at bringing disk-based publications to the PC over the years, most of them too complex and unwieldy to make an impact. The magazine on a disk is popular in many areas, and book titles have begun to migrate to the personal computer. But the software required to create such publications is expensive and difficult to master. Until now, with NeoBook. For short-run publications, putting your newsletter or a book on a diskette can be an economical alternative to traditional paper-based printing. And for promotions, your diskette is far less likely to end up as garbage than would a printed mailing. Of course, printed media will continue to have its place. It's still not comfortable or safe enough to read your computer while sitting in your favorite overstuffed chair or in the pool. But for many applications, the computer offers definite advantages over print in combining color, sound, and interactivity. NeoBook allows you to construct publications which would be impossible to duplicate in print. Storybooks in which the pictures speak the dialogue. Recipe books which print out a list of ingredients to make the grocer, for you to take to the grocer. Cartoons which reveal only the speech bubble when you click on the character. Historical timelines which bring up significant events when you click on a year. Interactive sales support materials and many more exciting new applications. NeoBook links to your favorite text editor or word processor and paint programs so you can use the commands and programs which you are familiar with without leaving NeoBook. Once you have placed your text, any images, and page-turning command buttons, you simply compile your publication, name it, and copy the resulting .exe program to a diskette for distribution. Amaze and impress your friends and coworkers with fabulous, easy-to-create multimedia presentations. Infomania is a text file librarian and an indexer. With it, you can store your text files on floppy disks instead of your hard drive, yet have quick access when you need the information, or better yet, just manage the text files on your hard drive. Infomania scans each file as you build your library and remembers where every word that contains three letters or more. When you need information, simply type in a couple of words and the program will display every file you have containing those words in a fraction of a second. You may then select a file viewer to view with the built-in file viewer, or insert the proper floppy disk if it's not in the drive already. These are just a few of the hundreds of new programs that arrive at the PCQ Bulletin Board each week. Call us 24 hours a day at 723-8489. This has been Paul Castorino, your prospector of the digital domain for Soundbites WXXI AM 1370 and WEOS 897 in Geneva.
And that puts the wrapper on Sound Bites for this Saturday, July 22nd, 1995. We're delighted that you could be with us today. And, of course, so are our panelists, Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray, whom we thank once again for their outstanding contribution. And thank all of you for your excellent questions as well. We'll be back again next week with more of Sound Bites. Rester Vale, our technical director, I'm Bob Smith. Thanks for joining.
You know, you might be able to do some inquiring around there.
It'd probably be Mac, would be my guess. Got a big Mac center.
Might be, but definitely call the school. I'm sure there's somebody who can say, oh, most of the school is X.
Yeah, do your homework on that one.
Take a look.
Sure. Hey, thanks for checking in. Wish we had more time for more calls, but unfortunately, that just about puts the wrapper on this particular June 3rd edition of Sound Bites. As always, we thank all those of you who checked in with us and called in today. Wish we could have accommodated even more calls, but when you know it, time flies while you're having fun. My thanks, as always, to Nick Francesco, to Dave Enright, Steve Ray, and Dan Rozica of the MLS Online Service, all with us today. And, of course, thanks always to all of you for another round of excellent questions on matters concerning computing. For Esther Vale, our technical director, I'm Bob Smith, inviting you to join us again next week at this same time for another edition of Sound Bites.
And allow you to enter in a new system folder or overwrite the existing one. And you want to do a clean install creating a new system folder.
It works. I can boot up and I see the new Mac OS mm-hmm. logo and it seems to work. I can, I copied it from one hard drive to another and actually opened up applications and ran them while it was doing that in the background.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty neat, but then I go and shut down, and my computer crashes.
Yeah, I've heard sporadic reports of crashing on shutdown, and it's usually was traced back to the disk driver. Check your version of FWB. It needs to be at least 1.6.3, if not 1.7. And that's usually the problem with a new operating system. You got to make sure your disk drivers are compatible.
Right. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
I'm here from Syracuse, and I just heard about your show.
All right.
Now you're going to go back and ask your public radio station why they aren't carrying us.
Well, can I get the station in Syracuse?
It's a bit of a stretch. Yeah. It's a bit of a stretch, but you can get it. It's on AM 1370 or try the Geneva FM at 89.7. You might be able to pick up either one or maybe both.
Okay. I'm curious.
Absolutely. Hey, thanks for checking in. I do believe that just about wraps up our time for the day. Sad to say, but our thanks, as always, to Nick Francesco, to Dave Enright, to Steve Ray, and to all of you for being with us on this edition of Soundbite. Matt Sophocledes taking over the engineer's chair today. And in his behalf, I'm Bob Smith. Thank you for being with us and inviting you to join us once again next week for another edition of Soundbites.